I underperform a market that makes me 350%, let's say I only make 300%, but I de-risk it. I take away company risk. That underperformance or relative underperformance is made up for by peace of mind and safety. So what are these wonderful stocks? I think you begin the construction with...
Rick, good afternoon to you. How are you, my friend?
Thank you, sir. In answer to the question, I'm wonderful. The better for being on with you. Thank you for having me back.
Anytime. We've had some great talks here, but really what I want to focus on in the first part of our talk, our discussion, is the Fed cut rates, and then they gave some indication, again, that they're not going to be as aggressive cutting rates. I think you have a tremendous advantage because you're also a banker. What exactly does this mean to you in 25 going forward as far as inflation, recession, and all that sort of thing?
I think cutting rates was the wrong decision for the country. It was good for me personally. Artificially low interest rates, and that's what a Fed rate cut means. The Fed wouldn't have to, I mean, the Fed probably shouldn't participate in interest rates at all. That should be left up to the market. But that's not what they're about. Artificially low interest rates, make no mistake, benefit people who have access to credit and people who have the knowledge to use it. It penalizes savers on behalf of spenders and investors. I'm not a spender. I'm notoriously stingy. But I am an investor. I have access to credit, and I have the knowledge to use it. So a Fed rate cut is invariably very, very, very good for me, but I would suggest it's not good for the country. People who have lived their life prudently, produced more wealth than they've consumed and saved the balance, if they aren't particularly sophisticated investors, put that money in deposit products or buy bonds. And for them, artificially low interest rates comes directly out of their pocket. It reduces the yield to savers and increases the yield to spenders, or at least the avoided cost to spenders, and the yield to investors like myself. If I were most of your listeners, prudent, well-meaning people, I'd be very careful about rate cuts because it lowers their yield on deposits, while many of them don't have the access to credit or the knowledge as to how to use credit correctly.
Yeah, that's well said. I've often thought of it as it really hurts the people, not only, I mean, the obvious people on fixed income, so it hurts the older population as well as the younger population because they don't have access to credit. And then they get hurt by inflation. But it also really hurts people that don't own assets. So that would be the poor, right? Correct?
Correct. Yeah. If you don't own assets, it perhaps permanently impairs your ability to acquire assets because people who do have access to credit before you've worked long enough to have access to credit yourself bid up the type of assets that you'd like to own. The average age now of a home buyer in the United States is 58 years of age. If you are a 20-something, that is trying to save as much money as they can, by the way, receiving artificially low interest rates on their savings, the ability to compete in credit markets with people who have been around a long time like me is nil. So it absolutely hurts those people. When you look at, in many markets, the price of single-family residential homes, by any metric that you care to choose, price versus rental income, you know, cap rate, things like that, are at all-time highs. And obviously the victim of that is the person who hasn't yet been able to buy a home, is struggling to buy a home, and is competing for that home, either with Wall Street with a permanently lower cost of capital or somebody like me. And with artificially low interest rates, it's not a fair fight.
Right. So let's go into then, what does this mean? One of our favorite topics, gold, precious metals, and that sort of thing. And what I mean that is, in the past year, it's been interesting. I've launched these discussions 2 years ago, and I've seen it grow really exponentially. And I have people both on camera that I've talked to in an interview with my friends, as well as off. They're interested in gold, but they have no idea what to do. So let's start with, what does this mean for precious metals with a rate cutting environment, if you would, around the world? And that's somewhat a rhetorical question, but I want you to answer it. And then we're going to talk about how.
Traditionally, Andy, gold has done well when savers are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in fiat denominated deposit products, be it treasuries, be it bonds, be it certificates of deposit. And I would suggest to you that savers have a real reason to be concerned today, not the least of which is the decline in nominal interest rates. Here's why. The U.S. government would have you believe that the correct measure of inflation is the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. I would argue that if you define inflation in non-academic terms, if you define inflation as the rate at which the purchasing power of your savings declines in fiat currencies, that the CPI is a very bad index. First of all, it doesn't include food or fuel, at least in terms of core inflation. For me personally, Andy, any index that doesn't include lunch is out of the question. You know, I don't want to know. The second thing is that it measures a basket of goods and services that is different often than the basket of goods and services that I consume. And also, it's hedonistically adjusted, which is to say that the people who compile the index manipulate the index. They don't track the price of the computer that you buy. They adjust that price, quote, hedonistically to reflect the utility that you enjoy. The third objection to it I have is that in terms of a measure of its cost of living, it doesn't include tax. But tax is the most important household expense of most working families in the United States. The idea that there's a measure of the deterioration of the purchasing power that doesn't include the largest single budget item in the country is laughable. Now, this is important because if your viewers look at inflation through the lens that I'm talking about, if they look at it as a measure of the deterioration of their purchasing power, the simple expedient of ignoring the CPI and just looking at the price increases in the goods and services that you use yourself over, say, the past 4 years provides a different picture. What's happened to gasoline prices? Home mortgage rates have doubled. Groceries have increased so fast that they've become a political issue. Health insurance, rent, pick one. The only thing that's down from the COVID area is used cars. That's it. And I, don't even get me started talking about what's happened to tax. So when I value the basket of goods and services that I consume, admittedly, I'm a crusty old stingy guy. I don't buy much. But the truth is that it appears to me that the value of my savings in terms of purchasing power has been declining at about 7.5% a year. Contrast that with the CPI at 2.6. And now let's get back to the original thesis. What happens to savings? Because it's what happens to savings that traditionally has been the motivator for people to go into gold. If you buy the world's benchmark savings instrument, the U.S. 10-year Treasury, the instrument that all other credit instruments in the world are priced off of, that instrument pays you 4.2% or something like that right now. Now, think about this arithmetic. They pay you 4.2% in a currency where your purchasing power is declining at 7.5%, which means that the U.S. government solemnly swears that if you lend them money for 10 years, they will make you 3% poorer every year for 10 years. A promise which, by the way, I believe they'll keep. But if you were looking for something that was going to make you concerned about the maintenance of your purchasing power in U.S. dollars, there's nothing quite so good as a government guarantee. I believe that the contra investment to gold are long-term U.S. treasuries, the most popular asset class in the world. And I believe that any arithmetic look at the yield of on the U.S. treasuries relative to the deterioration in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar is stark. And by the way, my friend Doug Casey once said the U.S. dollar is the worst currency in the world with the sole exception of every other. The U.S. dollar is perversely stronger, and I think will continue to be stronger than any other competing currency in the world. So I'm talking about the U.S. dollar in isolation. If you're an American, the U.S.-Canadian dollar exchange rate doesn't matter very much to you unless you go on vacation in Canada. You live your life in this country, and the fact that your purchasing power is declining by 7.5% and you're getting 4% on your savings means over time you have a problem. Traditionally, through history, when people have been confronted with the reality of that problem, they've turned to gold. Let me give you a historical example. Negative real and soft nominal interest rates were the feature of American finance in the period 1955 to 1970. Boom times from 1946 to 1968, 1969 were as beneficent an economic climate as we've seen in this country until 1982. Suffice it to say, wonderful post-war boom years, all that kind of stuff. But by the end of the decade of the 60s, it was not politically palatable to raise taxes. The marginal rate by then was 70%. And there were a bunch of debts that we had built up in the period of the 60s. Remember, well, you don't, you're too young, but we fought the war in Vietnam, which we lost, and then we fought the war in poverty, which we lost. And what we had left over was the bills. The problem that we had was that the value of our obligations was high relative to our ability to service them. And it was politically unpalatable to renege on promises that we'd made to Social Security recipients, among others. So what we did through the decade of the 70s was we simply inflated away the net present value of the obligations. The Social Security recipient who was promised, let's call it $400 a month, continued to get his $400 a month, but that $400 would only buy $100 worth of goods and services. The U.S. government estimates that during the decade of the 1970s, between 1970 and 1980, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar declined by 75%. And not coincidentally, the price of gold increased from $35 to $850. Some of that is unfair. Gold had been price controlled. So let's suggest that the move from $35 to $100 was merely making up for lost time. But the move from $100 to $850 was all about the deterioration in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar relative to the deposit interest rate that was paid. And I think we're right back there again.
Okay. So, first of all, before I forget, shout out to Doug Casey. I met Doug at the same place I met you in 1994.
His book is right there.
Signed. Second thing is looking at my grocery bill. We bring up groceries. So literally 2 years ago, my grocery bill went up about, within 2 years, 40%. That's anecdotal, but 40%. Not anecdotal because I would say that's just about everybody else that went down. So, and that's, I'm not even talking about family health insurance, which I don't even know because I don't really even know, but it's significant. The second thing is, I want your opinion on this. I think people are looking at it wrong because all I hear usually in our camp is the destruction of the dollar. And I think they're looking at it wrong, and I changed my opinion on that. Yes, the destruction of the dollar, but it's relative to what?
Right.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. The dollar is strong compared to other fiat currencies.
Right.
And I think it continues strong relative to other fiat currencies. If you had a circumstance where your income was in dollars and your expenses were in euros, you'd probably feel better than a circumstance where your income is in dollars and your expenditures in dollars. You live within the dollar, and the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar affects you. And it affects people around the world, too, because people have fled to the dollar as a consequence of the weakness in their own currencies. What large foreign dollar holders are finding, the Chinese and the Japanese as an example, is that the value proposition of owning a security that pays you 4% in a currency where the purchasing power is declining by 7.5% is still not a good deal, even if it's a better deal than your domestic market is. And so you're seeing disintermediation, which is the transfer of funds out of U.S. treasuries by foreign central banks in favor of other financial instruments, including, of course, famously, gold.
Yes. Okay, so let's talk about gold then, because going back to my original story here, if you would, launching this site, channel, etc., I'm getting asked not only by family members, but now by friends, what do I do? How do I buy gold? I know I need it, want it, but I don't know how. And to carry on that, I put together, this was years ago, a large portfolio for a wealthy family in Georgia. And we had an anchor of physical gold and the ETF that was over 50% of the portfolio. And then it was surrounded by really just the big players, the Barricks of the world, if you would. Walk me through that. How does a person that's very interested in getting gold, how do they get gold?
Let me start by being perverse,
please.
If you're American, hold some U.S. dollars too, as liquidity. Don't view it as savings. View it as an option. View it as having the ability to take advantage of a circumstance where the market gets illiquid, like 2008. So despite the fact that your purchasing power is deteriorating, maintain liquidity, if nothing else, to ensure that you're able to sleep well at nights, a real luxury. But begin to save in gold. How you do it really depends on you. There are people who both you and I know who suggest that if it isn't in your physical possession, you don't own it. They're that group of people that I laughingly call midnight gardeners because their storage is informal. If you decide that you want to be a midnight gardener, first of all, don't tell anyone. That invites guests to your house that you wouldn't normally have over for lunch. People who would prefer that your gold became their gold. In my youth, I was a midnight gardener. I was young, I was fast, I was strong, I was quiet, and I had a big backyard. All I have left is that big backyard, and I am no longer a midnight gardener. I hold a bit of bullion, not much, in a safe deposit box, in a bank, in a different country. I used to have a lot there. But it's inconvenient. If you buy gold where it's cheapest and then move it to the safe deposit box where you store it, it's heavy and it's dangerous to walk it down the street. And it's inconvenient. I have that gold, frankly, as a relic. And I have physical gold in a storage facility, Brinks, which is much more convenient for me. Brinks will sell it for me, as an example, without my lifting a finger, remit me the money. And if you're going to hold gold in your possession in a physical storage facility, make sure you know a lot about the physical storage facility. At Battle Bank, as an example, we will make loans to people against their holdings of physical precious metals only if that physical precious metals is at Brinks, Loomis, or Viamat. I want the vault to be owned by a public company so that I can see the income statement and the financial statement of the people who own the vault to make sure that they don't go broke and that my gold doesn't become, temporarily at least, in the possession of the bankruptcy courts. I also want best practices in terms of audit in the vault. I want KPMG or somebody to come and do one bar, two bar, three bar, four bar. In other words, I want to make sure my gold is there. So if you hold it in physical possession in your own name in a vault, make sure that the vault is secure. And I don't mean that it's concrete and steel. I mean that it's owned by a solvent company and that their audit practices are best practices in the industry. For me right now, the names are limited to Brinks, Loomis, and Viamat. You can affect that storage through your dealer. Know your dealer too. Learn something about the financial condition of your dealer. Because if you hold gold in unallocated storage, you don't actually have the gold. What you have is a claim on the gold. The gold is in your dealer's name. The gold can be lent out by your dealer to somebody else, and if they don't pay it back, the dealer has a problem, but you're an unsecured creditor of the dealer. So if you're doing business with a gold dealer, and there's several reputable ones, I would personally prefer that you held that gold in allocated, segregated storage rather than in unallocated storage. If you hold it in unallocated storage, make sure that you have access to the balance sheet and the financial statement of your dealer. Because understand that you have a secured interest in the gold, but it's not your gold, it's their gold. You're a lender, secured by gold. And if they go broke, you may get your gold back, but you have to go through the process of the bankruptcy court to do that. And that's not why you own gold.
Right.
Then there comes the whole range of physical surrogates. And I have most of my own bullion ownership in the Sprott surrogate products, in the Sprott Physical Gold Trust and the Sprott Physical Silver Trust in particular. The alternative to that is, of course, the ETFs. The Sprott products came about because Eric Sprott himself wanted a financial instrument that was backed by real gold, where the asset wasn't the counterparty's liability, but was rather backed 100% by physical gold. He looked at the ETFs and saw that because their assets pinched and swelled every day, because they had to add or redeem depending on the net asset value of the ETF, that some days they had deposit receipts as opposed to gold. In other words, that the ETFs themselves were unsecured creditors of the bullion banks. And while several people, myself included, argued to Eric that the risk associated with that was small, Eric argued back that he wasn't in the mood to take any risks. That's not why he owned gold. And that argument was fairly persuasive for me. So I sold my GLD and I bought the Sprott product. I attempted to talk him out of it. He talked me into it. But I don't really argue too strenuously about the big ETFs. I don't believe that their aggregate liabilities probably exceed 5% of net asset value. And my suspicion is that the ease with regards to buying and selling the ETFs relative to the risks, and in particular, relative to the risk of not owning gold at all, is fairly low. But however you choose to participate in the game, do participate. There is a lot to be said for the ownership of exchange-traded surrogates. I can buy the Sprott Physical Gold Trust or GLD with the click of a mouse, and I can sell it with similar ease. And the spread between the bid and the ask is 15 to 25 basis points. Whereas if you buy physical gold from a dealer and go to resell it to another dealer the same day, your spreads can be 6 or 7%. Hmm. 6 or 7% doesn't matter too much if you hold the gold over 10 years or 15 years. But most people aren't made up that way. And if you aren't made up that way, if you think you might need the gold or want the gold for liquidity in the 12-month or 18-month time frame, the difference between a 25 basis point spread and a 700 basis point spread is a lot. So consider, if you don't need physical ownership, consider one of the surrogates. The surrogates that I would prefer would be exchange-traded surrogates rather than a Mocatta certificate or a Perth Mint certificate, simply because of the low transfer costs and also the ease of, you know, dealing with them, literally buying them with the click of a mouse, literally selling them with the click of a mouse, with very, very, very low transaction costs. But the important thing, I think, irrespective of what form of gold ownership is most efficient for you, most comfortable for you, most convenient for you, is to do something. Gold, this amazes me. We were having the discussion before we went on the air about how incomplete knowledge of gold was in our market in the United States. The ownership of gold, physical precious metals, or put differently, the market share of precious metals and precious metals related assets relative to other savings and investment asset classes in the United States is tiny. Less than 0.5% of total savings and investment assets in the United States is denominated in precious metals. The four-decade mean is 2%. If precious metals ownership returns to historic means, I think it's going to go through it. But if it returns to historic means, that means the demand for the stuff grows fourfold. I have no idea what that will do to price, frankly. I don't have a price target. But I suspect that if you have a fairly thin market and you increase demand by four times, that it has a really outsized impact on price. Let's look at that, too, from a historical viewpoint. The reason I want you to look at it from a historical viewpoint is you don't need to overown gold. Because when it moves, for the reasons that cause it to move, it moves much further than people believe it's going to move. The sterling example, of course, poor pun, was the decade of the 1970s, when the gold price in 10 years moved from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce. What's that, a 30-fold move? I don't know what it is. It's big.
Yeah.
A more reasonable comparison is probably the decade 2000 to 2010. Pretty good gold bull market too, although most people didn't pay attention. But the gold price moved from $253 an ounce to $1,700, $1,800 an ounce, which is to say a seven-fold move.
Now,
Andy, when people interview me in circumstances like this, they often say, Rick, do you think that the gold price is going to go through 3,000? I could care less. 2,700 to 3,000? Pardon me? I own gold because I'm afraid that it's going to go through 9 or 10,000. If we have a circumstance where the arithmetic that I've described to you around the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar relative to the yield offered up on U.S. treasuries becomes widespread, the damage to the credit markets and the benefit to the gold market would be extraordinary. Am I telling you that this absolutely, positively, without fail, is going to occur? No. I'm telling you that it's a probability that you should insure against. And a little bit goes a long way. Let's say that coming into the decade of the 1970s, that you were a retired person and you'd enjoyed the period 1946 to 1970 a lot. You know, if you had put 10% of your wealth in gold and you had 50% of your wealth in U.S. treasuries and 40% of your wealth in stocks, the stocks over the course of the decade would have lost you 30%. The long treasuries would have lost you 50%. So you'd be down an average of 40% of your wealth. But your gold would have increased in price 30-fold. which means that it would have more than offset, although it was only 10% of your portfolio, the losses that you had endured on 90% of your portfolio. A better example might be the decade 2000 to 2010, where financial assets did well, frankly. The truth is, had there been a problem with the treasury market, or had there been a problem with the stock market, an investment of 10% of your portfolio in gold would have seen a sevenfold improvement in that asset over the course of 10 years, which is to say, it would have shielded your portfolio from a lot of sin other places. Now let's look at the probability of that sin. I'm going to leave the equity market out of it because I don't consider the equity market to be a savings product. I see it as an investment product. The U.S. Treasury is an obligation of the U.S. government. First of all, the economic proposition is lousy. They absolutely, positively will pay you back interest and principal. They'll do that because they have recourse to the printing press. But they'll pay you back 4.2% in a currency where I believe the purchasing power is declining by 7.5%. In other words, they guarantee you a 3% annual loss. So the arithmetic around the U.S. 10-year treasury is, from my point of view, not good. Caveat, I own some 18-month treasuries for liquidity, just not the long ones. But let's look at something else, which is to me a lot more treacherous. That is that the on-balance sheet liabilities of our country, that is to say the debt owed the bondholders, now exceeds $36 trillion, or $29 trillion net of the Treasury's own holdings of bonds. In other words, some of our debt we own ourselves. So let's call it $29 trillion net, a paltry sum. But we add back to that a truly frightening sum. The net present value of the off-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government, promises that we've made, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, federal pensions, military pensions, that number, according to the Congressional Budget Office, exceeds $100 trillion. By the way, that's one of the lower estimates out there. The debt clock, debtclock.org, suggests that the net present value of unfunded liabilities exceeds $220 trillion. But let's use the little number, $100 trillion. Now let's add back the $29 trillion that's on balance sheet. Our federal government, that doesn't include state government, local government, private debt, or corporate debt, that number is $129 trillion. Andy, let's put that in perspective. The Internal Revenue Service, who has an interest in these things, suggests that their estimate of private wealth in the United States, wealth owned by you and me, is about $141 trillion. So if you take all the money that all of us have as individuals, before you liquidate the federal government, sell off the national parks, do that kind of stuff, that number is $141 trillion. And we've already spent $129 trillion of it. This is truly staggering.
Right.
And that number grows. Right. Every year, the on-balance sheet obligations of the U.S. government are increasing by $2.5 trillion a year. And the off-balance sheet obligations are estimated to also be increasing by $2.5 trillion a year. So every year, we're getting $5 trillion deeper in debt. That $5 trillion is an interesting number because it's a little larger than the gross income of the federal government before they spend any money on anything, including debt service, which is to say our debt is growing faster than our gross revenues, not our income. I think that it is as politically unpalatable today to cut entitlements, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut military pensions. Remember, some of those guys know how to shoot. Cut Medicare. I think it's as unpalatable today as it was in 1968. So what I think happens is that some old codger named Rick Rule continues to get his Social Security check. I don't know what it is, $4,000 a month, something like that. I think we continue to get the nominal value of our benefits. I think they fiddle around the edges, right? I think they probably increase the age that you have to be to receive it. I think that they probably remove the cap that rich people have on their Social Security payments. And I think they probably means test it, which means actually for old fat guys like me, I probably won't get it. But that's fiddling around the edges. What will happen for most people is that they'll get their benefit, but they'll inflate away the net present value of the benefit. They'll do precisely what they did in the decade of the 70s. They will reduce the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar by, say, 75%. I might be wrong, in which case the normal investments that you have in your portfolio will do as well as they have the last 10 years. But the arithmetic that I've just showed you, which is to say the negative accretion of value that you enjoy today and the probability that that inflation increases in the future, is, I think, high enough that somebody who doesn't own gold as an insurance policy is crazy. Crazy.
Aaron. So let's go back to that. Do you really see a crystal ball in the future in 1970s do-over again that we're heading to?
I think the wisecrack is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. I don't personally, and I'm not an economist, I'm a credit guy, right? I don't see politically how we cut entitlements.
Yeah.
I don't see functionally how we raise taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these morons say, we can solve this by taxing billionaires more. The IRS suggests that the total net worth of America's billionaires is $5.6 billion. Never mind increasing their taxes. If you stole all their money, they fund the on-balance sheet and off-balance sheet deficit of the United States government for about a year and a quarter. If you stole everything. So tax cuts of the magnitude that would be required to end the deficits are impossible. They're arithmetically impossible. To me, the only way out of this predicament, the only way that you nominally service $129 trillion in debt is that you inflate away the net present value of the obligation. Yeah. I don't see another way out of it.
I agree.
I would love it if I could. I'd love not to have to worry about this.
Yeah. I would agree. So I want to give people, I want to ask another question, but before I do that, I want to give people a taste. You offer one of the best values out there in the rule. And I'm not just saying this just for your ego. It really is one of the best out. And I don't understand why you charge what you do, because it's next to nothing. But it's one of the best values out there. You're going to go over this. So tell us about that first. And then I want to ask you about investing. So tell us about
Let me talk about three values I offer.
Yes.
The easiest value to talk about is the ranking service at ruleinvestmentmedia.com.
Yes, I've got it. It's fantastic. Go ahead.
If you list your natural resource stocks, I will personally rank them for free. No obligation. Andy, free is a pretty damn good price. You know, I've been trying to lower it, but I can't figure out how. The second value that I offer is in the Rule Classroom. In the Rule Classroom, there's a couple hundred hours of instructional programming, and there's a free 1 hour long question and answer session with myself almost every Thursday. Again, that's free. Pretty good deal. Can't lower the price. The value that you're talking about is something different. Every 90 days or so, we do a very deep dive into one topic. When I say deep dive, 8 hours. And the truth is that we give you more information in 8 hours than you can absorb in 8 hours. So really, you need to budget 24 hours. You need to listen to the presentation, either live or delayed, and then you need to play the tapes at least two more times. what that means is that if you're the kind of person who buys a newspaper to read the funny papers, don't come. This is not for tourists. This is not an entertainment product. We cover one subject in really, really, really strong detail. The one that's coming up is going to be about gold. How did we choose gold? We didn't. Our customers chose it. We asked people in the boot camps what they wanted us to talk about. And anytime that they suggest a topic that we think we can talk about, we talk about. So we're going to do gold. We're going to talk about why gold, like we've done today, but in excruciating detail. We're going to talk about how to do it, specifically how to do it. Then we're going to move on to investing in gold mining companies, starting with the senior gold stocks, the investment quality stocks, talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly, and how you judge between them. And then we're going to get, for those who want, down into speculation, how you can attempt to achieve alpha, outperformance in some gold stocks over others. But we're going to start with gold as an investment. We're going to start with physical gold. We're going to explain to people the difference between numismatic, semi-numismatic, and bullion. We're going to talk about various physical asset classes in more detail than we have today. Again, if you don't have an abiding interest in the topic, if you aren't prepared for 8 hours of hard work, and if you don't look forward to playing the tape again so that you can pick up the information that you didn't pick up the first time, don't come. Don't come to the class. Go fishing or go gardening or play with your kids or do something intelligent with your time. But if you care about the topics that we've talked about today, and if you share some of our concerns and you are interested in possible solutions, if you care about optimizing the part of your portfolio that is gold, I think it's going to be a wonderful value. I'm so certain of that value, frankly, Andy. I think you know this. In 28 years of offering up investment education and financial information, we have always had an absolute gold-plated money-back guarantee. If you pay the tuition, come to the boot camp, you don't think for any reason that we haven't given you your money's worth, no questions asked, email us, we'll give you a refund. Mercifully, in 28 years, I've had to refund less than 0.1% of the tuitions I've charged, often because I've done disclaimers like this, saying that if you're only passingly interested, pass, don't come. But if you're deeply interested, there's an absolute money-back guarantee. Financial risk is mine, but you will have lost 8 hours of your life.
I'm going to put links to all of this in the show notes so people can get directed to you. And I do want to whet people's appetite a little bit more. I'm going to try to do this. Or let's try to do this in 5 minutes, which takes 8 hours.
We'll hire you to run the course if you can do it.
So let's just go back to gold as an investment here. And very 30,000 foot view here. What I would do, and this is not advice, and this I don't speak for you, is start with the major producers here. That's just what I would do. Comment a little bit about that, and then working your way down the food chain. This is after you have physical gold in whatever form that is, whether that's bullion, whether that's an NETF, or whether that's in Sprott's products. Just talk to me about just more of the construction investment in stocks, if you would.
Well, absolutely start with a physical. Absolutely start with, you know, start with insurance, right? Build a base.
Right.
But then, if in addition to saving in gold, you want to invest, which is a different process, start with the highest quality. What you learn, what I've learned over 50 years, is that the beta in a gold bull market, beta I define as the outperformance of the gold sector relative to the broad market, is so extraordinary that you want to be in place, and you want to be in place with as little risk as you can. Historically, gold bull markets have yielded between 250 and 500% beta over 3, 4, or 5 years. Ironically, if you buy the best of the best, you actually underperform the market a little bit because the more marginal companies benefit from increases in gold price. What I've learned is that if I underperform a market that makes me 350%, let's say I only make 300%, but I de-risk it, I take away company risk, that underperformance or relative underperformance is made up for by peace of mind and safety. So what are these wonderful stocks? I think you begin the construction with Franco-Nevada, the best of the best. Very high quality assets that always yield surprises, and those surprises are always good. A little cheaper than normal because the Panamanian government stole an asset from them that comprised 15% of their net asset value. The consequence of that is that the share price declined by 40%. I believe there's a reasonable possibility that, there's a certainty that they go to international arbitration concerning that. And I don't think the Panamanian government can afford to pay them for it. So I think some settlement is in order. Going from Franco-Nevada, I think you go to Wheaton Precious, the second highest quality gold equity on the planet. Coming down the quality trail to a producer, I think the highest quality producer in the world is Agnico Eagle. Wonderful allocators of capital, wonderful development pipeline, wonderful operating margins in an industry where some people have not been able to translate higher gold prices into higher margins. And for many people, I'd stop right there. And if you want to go further, we'll give you some other names. I don't want to give them now because all of those names have warts. And on every name, I want to explain the risks and I want to explain them in detail. So yes, we'll talk about Newmont, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Yes, we'll talk about Barrick. Yes, we'll talk about Endeavor. Absolutely, positively, we'll talk about those names. But those names are not of the same quality as Franco, Wheaton, and Agnico, which we can talk about without substantial disclaimer.
Yeah. That's perfect. Thank you, Rick. And by the way, your conference, Agnico, was there. And another reason that your conference...
I have a history with Agnico Eagle that goes all the way back to Paul Penna 50 years ago. And they have a warm spot in my heart. I remember Paul Penna coming to conferences 45 years ago when he was already a very wealthy guy. And I watched him talking with equal interest to a widow that had 500 shares and somebody like Eric Sprott, just a decent human being. Yeah. I also remember him at the end of the conference packing up all of the unused promotional material to take back to Montreal, when the promoters from Nothing Nowhere companies would always throw that stuff away in the trash can. And I was struck by the difference between the tycoon who saved all of his material and the buffoon who threw all their material away. The culture in Agnico Eagle has been spectacular. He handed it off, of course, to Sean Boyd, who has both been a benefactor of mine, and by way of saying he's made me a lot of money, but he's also become a friend.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful circumstance. And I could say the same thing, frankly, for Randy Smallwood, the CEO of Wheaton Precious. I'd known him for 40 years. And Pierre Lassonde, the founder of Franco-Nevada, whom I've also known for 40 years. Wonderful stewards of capital and spectacular human beings.
Yeah. Well, this is a completely different topic we got to touch on someday, but it's about culture and company culture. And you just gave that a great 3,000-foot view of stories in 2 minutes. So thank you for that. So, Rick, you got to go. I'm sure you're a busy guy, but it's always just such a pleasure. I'm going to put everything in the show notes below and love to have you on again really soon.
Now, listen, I want to do that, but I look forward at some point in time to be interrogated by the second generation of Millett. I understand that she has some questions for you, but she's been too shy. So I want you to tell her that there's nothing intimidating about a 71-year-old fat, bald guy, and she needs to come on, and we need to visit.
You got it. I'm going to have her on, and she has to listen to this entire interview in its entirety to get that message, but I'm going to tell her she has. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.